Thank you, Honorable Chair. And the police used to arrest us. In some instances, they would say they want water. And you didn't know what's going to happen. And you accepted water quickly. Because you didn't have a sense of what the change was going to be. Thanks for the opportunity, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. And maybe before I get to the stuff, I want to thank you, Honorable Chair, for clarifying something which I suspect is the reason why the Honorable Members are advising me to bring more Red Bulls. I just want to say, without deviating, that I wish this matter can find a resolution, because in my entire history, I believe in the noble purpose of accountability. I hope one, it will be a combination of both legality and political leadership that is going to be resolved. But having said that, we are here, Honorable Chair, for the second time. We had thought we were going to appear here on a monthly basis. And we thank the committee for allowing us a space to actually try to actually improve the best we can do this work. I am with the DDC from the presidency, Ms. Miko, GHC, on my left and on my right. I am with Mr. Tim Jonathan, who is dealing with the digitization of our system. He's going to share that with us, the highlights of that. We will try to, we have moved since we met. Our report is on the progress. Remember, the challenge was, what role is the presidency playing in ensuring that the SIU findings are implemented? Indeed, we were activated by this committee, and then we've been doing that work. And it's been a journey which is, I find it very exciting. It's not an easy one, but it's revealing. We will also share, we anticipate that if that includes the Zondo recommendation, that includes the NACAC, the anti-corruption, the advisory councils, where all the anti-corruption stuff and the intervention that are dealing with the cleaning of the states, we hope our system is going to take care of that. And what are we trying to do? Our system is such that it is going to be, it demonstrates that there has been an analysis of the anatomy of all the components that deal with the information with regard to corruption and with their different roles. And then Jonathan will speak about that. We did show a bit of that. That shows here a number of role players, but here is a poor coordination and poor processes of information. So our digitization has been actually seeking to say, how do you align those in a digital way? How do you make sure that you've got clarity of the role of each player and ensure seamlessness with regard to how they work? We're at a stage where I think we're on course somewhere, but of course, when we come to the portfolio committee, we're coming for counseling, so that in the process of our presentation, if you pick up weaknesses in what we're trying to do, we are open to improve it. Having said that, Chair, today's report is specifically focusing on the progress report of the SIU implementation of their findings. At the same time, the technology that we're actually using as a platform to secure that seamlessness at the end will be presented by Mr. Tim. The report is it actually is structured in a manner that will ensure that, one, we should be presented by Ms. McCobalt. It deals with the proclamations issued since 2001, proclamations issued during this current financial year. It also deals with reports submitted to the President since 2001, and it reflects them on a spherical approach. How many in local governments since 2001, how many in national governments, all the reports submitted, whether interim or final. It also deals with the reports received since last COPPA appearance. It also deals with the analysis of the three categories of referrals, which is administrative referral, which is the NPA, a criminal referral, and then the additional reference, and it's going to analyze all those referrals and look at where we in each. At the end, Mr. Tim will come and just give us the process of digitizing the ecosystem of the environment where we are going to work. Without further ado, I'll ask Ms. Migwa to take us through. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to you, and good morning to the committee members. And good morning to my... As we are talking about digitization, Chair, and good morning also to my colleagues from the SIU. Chairperson, yes, we are just maybe, through your permission, Minister, allow Advocate Motivi just to introduce the team. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Minister, Honourable Members of SCOPA, Honourable Chair. I'm Andy Motivi, the head of the SIU. I'm joined by Mr. Lekgetho, who's the SIU Chief National Investigating Officer. He oversees the investigations in SIU that leads to all these referrals. And then I'm also joined by Mr. Pranesh Maharaj, who in the value chain is the Chief Procurement Portfolio Officer. And by Program Portfolio Officer would include also monitoring the implementation of the SIU referrals by various state institutions. Him and his team has been very key in working with the presidency's team to ensuring that we reach where we are. And we are really glad to say we've really reached this stage. We can see really traction. But I'll pause here, Chair, and just allow the team to proceed.
Maybe to say, Chair, within us and SIU, I would call it a cooperative candid relationship. They are independent. They must do their work the way they're so feel. But you understand that that independence doesn't preclude us from working cooperatively because the goal is common. Thank you very much.
Indeed, Minister. Thank you very much. Chairperson, in my culture, when the host makes an offer, it cannot be rejected, so I'll take you on the offer of water. Thank you. I think the Minister has just sketched the first few slides of this presentation. Thank you. I think I would like then probably just to zoom straight to slide number 5, Chair. Now, this slide talks to the proclamations that were issued by the President to authorize the SIU to undertake investigations. Chair, you'll recall the first time we appeared, we committed ourselves that the appearance was triggered by Proclamation 23 of 2020, however, which is related to the PPE. However, we did indicate that we are not only going to be focusing on that proclamation or the investigations that related to PPE, because we were not oblivious to the fact that there's a legacy or historic report that are still outstanding. So what is in this slide, it just gives you a sense of those proclamations that were issued since 2001. But I think interesting, or what maybe we can take as a bad course from this slide, is that when you look at the period 2010, 2011, 2011 to 2012, you see a spike of the proclamations. And it tells an interesting story, because we know that 2010 was the huge procurement as a result of the World Cup, of the 2010 World Cup. And then you see there that there were a number post that the World Cup, there was a number of proclamations that the President issued. And that was then subsequently followed up by discussions that led to the fast track settlement facilitated by the Competition Commission. And I'm highlighting this, Chair, is that then you see the period that follows, that there's a downward movement slightly from that spike in period of 2010, 11 to 12. But then a very interesting picture begin to emerge. You look at 2017, 2018, you see again a spike where there were 18 proclamations again issued there. And in this case, our analysis shows that it was really as a result of the procurement that was driven by the SOEs and the municipalities. So again, you see a pattern. Then you see another extremely interesting quantum leap for the period 2019-2020. And we all know that's what really triggered the proclamation 23. And this was as a result of the huge procurement relating to PPEs. So this picture shows you, Chair, that if you sit and do a self-critical analysis of ourselves, you will see that we were beginning to become a country that feasts on huge procurement. And as a result, the role that SIU played in doing this investigation, assisting the president to make sure that we track them, cannot be underscored. But again, what needs to be underscored, Minister spoke about the relationship. This relationship has also included the AG, because during the Quantum Leap PPE years, or during those proclamations, we saw the president giving the AG, not that they don't have that legislative mandate, but the president saying to the AG, real-time audits to be performed or undertaken, and as part of them supporting this work that the SIU is doing. So there are currently 67 proclamations that can be categorized as active by the SIU, and then when we go through, you'll see how those are being unpacked. In the next slide, Chair, it gives you a sense of the proclamations under the current financial year, the year beginning 1st April 2022 to 31st March 2023, and so it includes the third quarter of the financial year. Again, a takeaway here, and we'll unpack the details, but the takeaway here, it shows you that there's a total of 16 proclamations that have been issued. And leading the pack there is the Eastern Cape Provincial Department of Health. I think what is going to be interesting as well as we unpack this slide further, Kay, is that you can see that the areas that are being affected whenever the SIU investigates relating to a procurement, it is always infrastructure that is involved, and it tells you a pattern and a story of South Africa as a country. But again, the other interesting point to take away is that there is now a correlation between the previous slide and this slide as well, and the other slides that are coming, because you'll see in terms of this pattern is that it cuts across all spheres of government. It's at provincial level, it's at the national level, it's at the local government level, and it also involves state entities, which then shows you that malfeasance and corruption, really, they don't just target one sphere of government, but it's just across. And the work that we are doing with SIU, it's not only in terms of tracking the history of what has happened, but it's also building a preventative mechanism so that we can be able to protect the state from this. Then the next slide, I think Minister has introduced that. We can just maybe shoot to slide number 8 and giving you a sense, Chair, of a total of 162 reports that have been issued to the President since 2001. And of the 162, you see that the bulk, 132, are at the final stage, and 28 are at the interim reporting stage. So the distinction between the two, Chair, is that once a report is at the final stage, it means that it can be acted upon once it's the SIU hands it to the President. And then the one that is interim, it means SIU will give to the President, but just to give progress and identify the process that they are following, identify where challenges are, and how they are dealing with unbottlenecking those challenges. So then the President will then issue correspondence to all affected departments and ministers. in terms of the recommendations by the SIU. But it doesn't end only with just being a postbox chair of issuing those reports. The mechanism that my colleague Ndadeti will talk to later on will show you also in terms of now how we are beginning to knit this thing together in terms of accountability that the minister spoke about earlier on, and also ensuring that there's also transparency around how we are holding the departments to account to the recommendations by the SIU. So 14 reports have been submitted to the president since the last time we appeared, Chair, and we'll talk to those again in the following slides. The final takeaway from this slide is that if you look at the pie chart on the right there, which shows you that where the highest reports have been, we should not be oblivious to the 7%, which is a small fraction, fraction that comes from the state-owned companies, because, Chair, they may represent a small number in terms of the reports issued, but when you look at the quantitative and the qualitative and even the financial threshold, the story is something else. So again, we're hoping that with the system and later on as we continue briefing the scope, we will be unpacking the qualitative, the quantitative and the financial threshold of the report. In the next slide, it's just the same, but now it gives the chair and the committee members the details relating to the report. We won't go through all of them in detail. Safe to say that of the 14, 10 are at the final stages and they're being acted upon through the referral letters, and the 4 are at an interim stage. And the details there, just to show you already that the system that we are working on is beginning to put together the date when we receive the report and the details of what the report relates to, and then, of course, how we then follow up in terms of those referrals, Chair. And then the next slide that we can zoom into will be slide 11. Chairperson, this one now talks to the progress on the disciplinary referrals. As Minister indicated that we are zooming now in terms of the three categories, so starting with the disciplinary ones. A bit of reflection in terms of our findings to date as part of the team led by Mr. Tim and excuse the pun there. We're beginning to see that part of the challenges that are still confronting us are that there are low level of compliance by some of the departments in terms of what they need to do to update the status of their disciplinary cases on PESAL. PESAL is the system that we use within the public service. It tracks really, it's supposed to be the in-all of the an employee or an official within the public service. So, but we still find that most of the departments, they are still not complying to the T with that. So the report by DPSA indicates that this poor compliance, because they DPSA requires that on a quarterly basis, all the departments will submit that report. So what we are trying to do even here is through the DG in the presidency, who is the head of FOSAT, to escalate and use that FOSAT to bring that kind of discipline to the accounting officers or to the DGs, because it should begin there and then it will cascade down to the rest of the departments. One observation that something that gradually, and we hope that our end state, our envisioned stage, our future, our Rolls Royce would be a system that will allow us to move away from the manual tracking and where we can be able to track this by a click of a button. But we are also bringing to the committee's attention that analysis of the PPE disciplinary cases on PESAL, they're beginning to show a picture that we know it's been existing, but it was very difficult to track, that certain officials, they jump ship, they resign immediately, they are aware that they are being investigated or they are being taken through a corrective action or disciplinary process. So the end state of where the system, we would like the system to take us, is that the linkage of PESAL should be able to say, even if you do that as an official, you jump ship, you don't land on the other side softly or cushioned. person will be able to track you and be able to take your file wherever that you are going, that you cannot be able to escape. So where are we in terms of progress? We have now shared the referrals has been received from SIU with the DPSA. But not only have we shared the referrals, Chair, as I said, that if the prisons we just don't become a post box, we have already shared our proposed corrective and remedial actions. And as I said, also to say that the DG in the presidency to be the one that, as these reports are tabled, that force us to hold the DGs accountable there. There's a process of data cleansing and to make sure that there's an alignment. And here, what we wanted to do, we want to avoid information asymmetry. DPSA has given commitment, and it's a firm commitment to follow up on all the correspondence that has been issued at all spheres of government, national and provincial in particular, and so to make sure that they begin to enforce that culture of accountability, because this is already legislated in the PFMA in terms of Section 50, but it's just a matter of now upping our game. We do have a team that involves DPSA, COPTA, Department of Public Enterprises, National Treasury, and DPME, that is designing this system that you're talking to, but also ensuring implementation of a centralized register for dismissals. So as I said, Chair, that you cannot be able to find yourself on the other side as an official. So as we diagnose the problem, we provide solutions, Chair. So we don't diagnose and then get it to the end state first, as and when we build as we are going. On slide 12, Chair, it's just to indicate now an analysis of the information that I shared on the previous slide. The total of 265 referrals for disciplinary action are contained in the SIU data set, which we have analyzed. And I think you see there by the numbers, Chair, that the greatest number of referrals are for eThekwini Metro with 75, followed by the Limpopo Department of Education with 36 referrals, and the table below then gives you a sense of the other departments as well. In the next progress update report, we will also begin and to pie chart this information, Chair, just to make it a little bit easier. But so again, looking at the where the SOEs are involved, where is the municipality, where is the government department, both national and provincial. Okay, the next slide then gives you just a sense of the numbers, Chair, on the disciplinaries, and in particular relating to the COVID-19 procurement the proclamation. Here, Chair, there are 253 individuals that were affected by the different stages of the disciplinary referrals. And this, all of them, they have now resulted in 65 officials that have been found guilty of different transgressions and misconduct. And of these, 9 officials have been dismissed. 1 was promoted, and 5 have been suspended without pay for various length of time. And 23 have been issued with a written warning. 1 official has been sent for corrective counseling. There are 26 officials that have been found guilty, but sanctions are still awaited to be finalized. So again, Chair, as we continue developing the mechanism to improve, we will ensure that again we continue analyzing the data and we unpack the information again at the different spheres of government. On slide 14, it's a progress on administrative referrals. These are referrals that relate to regulatory and professional bodies. Just the findings from the initial work that has been done to date. is that SIU do make recommendations for blacklisting chairperson. So, and those are also then shared with the various departments or entities that are affected. And as they are shared with the accounting officers, they also give the other parties an opportunity as required by the rules of natural justice, that they provide reasons as to why their entities they should not be blacklisted. I know that sometimes this chair, because there's been frustrations around some of these entities that continue to benefit out of malfeasance, and then we are constantly asked in terms of following this process. But unfortunately, Chair, you don't want really to be charged of throwing the baby with the bathwater, whereby you don't follow a proper process and then you defeat what could have been a good end game. So we do, the accounting officers, they do provide a time for the companies to indicate why they should not be blacklisted. And then based on that, then there's an engagement with the chief procurement officer, and then ultimately a decision is taken to blacklist a service provider. In terms of progress, you will see, Chair, I won't go bullet point by bullet point, but it's safe to say that there has been value on the engagements between ourselves as the presidency and the PME, our sister department, the SIU, and the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. As Minister indicated earlier on, that all of us, we are fishing in the same river. And for us to make sure that we catch and we catch big is to make sure that we work together. And so we're beginning to see good progress coming out of this collaborative effort. But also we do analyze our BAS system. The BAS is the basic accounting system that we use because this also talks to the level of compliance on the restricted supplier database, and also to be able to say you have a separate register of all service providers that have been blacklisted. Some of the conversations are around now as the system matures, as Mr. Tim will talk to it later on, it will be also things like the extent to which, or the tenure or the duration to which you will be blacklisting a service provider. And then on the next slide, Chair, it just gives you a sense of blacklisting by institution, and we will give the details on the next slide of this, but a good takeaway here is that you can see that Eskom is leading the pack of the suppliers that are being blacklisted, followed by Transnet. And I think on that note, Chair, it's safe to go to the next slide, because the next slide just gives you a sense of the details on the numbers. So, as I said, that Eskom is leading the pack, is followed by the Free State Provincial Department with 56 suppliers restricted, and Transnet 51, and Umgeni Water Board 49. But what is very interesting as well is Eskom has indicated that it has blocked 71 suppliers. So the difference here between blocking a supplier and restricting them is that they block them while the process of investigation is underway. So again, it's something that we believe that it gives confidence to say the reports are being dealt with in a serious light. And with regard to the Free State Provincial Treasury, they are working on restricting 56 service providers. We are not happy with the feedback we received from the Umgeni Water, and the team will continue engaging there, because they have indicated that they are considering legal advice on the recommendations. So we will continue nudging Chair to make sure that we don't hang this for long. And finally, it's our report related to the Mexica. They have referred the 16 suppliers to be restricted by National Treasury. We just want the committee to take note that Since June, when we presented our last, we provided the last report, we have not received the recommendation for blacklisting, but we are keeping our eye on the chair. Slide 17 talks to criminal referrals. Again, the findings from our initial engagements is that where SIU referrals are not considered prosecution ready by the NPA, they are not just left their chair. They are then referred to DPCI, which is the ROCS, for further investigation. But I think the advice that we have, we are heeding to, coming both from the NPA and from the SIU, is that the hawks should be brought to the party much earlier through the process of the investigations. And similar view is being shared with regard to the asset forfeiture. And I think that is, again, the value of having to work as a team, that we begin to realize that you don't have to wait until the end to bring the hawks in. But we do also know the blind spot that the challenge of sharing progress between the NPA and the SIU is still there, but it's being worked on. And I think, Chair, when we talk to the progress on the MOU, we will share in terms of how we think the MOU is beginning to unlock that. The challenge of multiple data systems, it does make tracking very, very difficult, and we hope that our ultimate system is going to take away this problem, that we will have a centralized portal where then everything else will be coordinated. In terms of progress, Chair, we did facilitate as the presidency what we saw as a very critical intervention. There is now an MOU between the SIU, the NPA, DPCI, and the SAPS Detective Services, which then brings these great minds together to pull towards a common goal. And we've also made sure that the officials that are responsible for data systems from both the NPA and the SIU are in touch with one another, they share information, and they just make sure that there is alignment. So there are also attempts to analyze that data set, but gaps are still existing and there are still areas of inconsistency. But as I said, Chair, we are building as we build, we fix, and as we see challenges, we identify what are relevant solutions for that problem, because again, a one-size-fits-all will not work at all times. And of course, we are exploring opportunities to bring in what lies in the fusion center in terms of their case management system, and this we think will become a bit clearer as we embark on phase two of developing the coordinating and monitoring mechanism. What are the next steps? Continuing with the monitoring and supporting the progress on the implementation of the MOU between those entities referred to. We'll continue to enhance the business processes and then make sure that the mapping yields the intended outcomes. And of course, to link various data systems, starting with the NPA and the SIU, so that we get to that ultimate end goal. But there are, small gains that are being made, and we celebrate every milestone, regardless of whether it's big or small. And we the fact that in the past we never had a universal reference number for these matters, which now has been resolved, it's taking us to a system that will be able, really honestly, to make sure that not only are we cleaning up the past, but we are being preventative going forward. And of course, there will be a sweeping exercise for monitoring the outcomes for the criminal referrals. So slide 18, Chair, I won't repeat because it just talks to the details of the MOU and what we intend to do in terms of standardizing the report and making sure that we do away with fragmentation and the silos. Slide 19 is just an overview of the criminal referrals, and Che gives you there a sense of, we have a total of 346 referrals criminally, and then you can see that Gauteng is leading the pack there, sitting at the, 65%, and the followed then by followed by the KwaZulu-Natal and Limpopo. We have 74 matters that are currently in court, and again, something that shows that the wheel is turning, maybe it's turning a little bit slower, grinding not to a pace that all of us would want, but at least it is turning. But this excludes the referrals that are managed through the fusion center. And again, as we continue providing progress update, we will be able at the next presentation to provide how those are progressing as well. So Chair, the takeaway here as well is that you will see that, you know, the provinces that are challenged are the provinces that indeed they are big, firstly in terms of size. If you look at Gauteng, you would expect. But the test is going to be the speed within which we clean up this and change this picture. What is disturbing is the Eastern Cape, that you would look at the Eastern Cape and you would look at the level of impoverishment at in the province, but then you see that the instead of, you know, the province presenting progress in terms of how they are dealing with improving, and then you still see them in this unpalatable pie chart. The next slide, on slide 20, Chair, there we just want to highlight three matters, as a matter of fact, that the bulk of the referrals that came out of the PPE investigation, they have resulted at least in two guilty verdicts. As I said, they will turning, although slow, but it is turning. 12 arrests with 8 more arrests that are currently outstanding. There are other matters that are in court, 8 of them, and 3 are still awaiting court dates. But I think what is very pleasing, Chair, if you look at the SIU report, is that a total of 59 matters, they have been enrolled with the special tribunal. And I think this was a very important intervention because it has assisted in expediting the matters that usually could be locked in the court in the court system. In terms of financial implications, really at a high level, Chair, we wanted to share with the committee that all these actions that we have mentioned, they have resulted in a recovery of just above 36 million in cash or assets. The assets that have been set aside, and also we have close to 730 million for the set aside. And then, Chair, for the next slide and the concluding remarks, I will hand over then to Jonathan just to share with the committee at the high level the progress we are making in establishing the coordinating and monitoring mechanisms. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister. Good morning to the Honourable Chair and the Honourable Members and colleagues present. I'm going to provide just a high-level overview of this project, which aims to deliver a coordinating and monitoring mechanism, which is in essence envisaged as a system of systems, so linking up systems. Chair, there's an additional slide in this presentation that is on the screen but not in the pack, if I apologize for that. I can share this slide, but I'll talk. Apologies, Chair. If I can just talk to this
slide just provides an overview and a context to the slide that follows that is in your pack. We have been engaged in this effort for approximately 12 months. We're following a methodology that is known as problem-driven, iterative, and adaptive approach, which in essence means that we work very much in the context and in a mode of discovery as opposed to trying to design a system off-site. So we are, it's an agile approach, and we are really trying to create, through this process, the conditions in which we will be able to implement. I think this is one of the big challenges with especially IT and change processes, is that you design outside of the context in which you need to implement, and you often make assumptions about capacities and capabilities that become killer assumptions. So there are essentially four focus areas of this this project in terms of implementation activities currently. So we're looking at the processes for the coordination and tracking of the recommendations and referrals. And these are across the different institutions, from SIU as the issuing to the various types of implementing environments. So we've basically got five categories of referrals that arise from the SIU investigations. The first is the criminal referrals. The second are for civil litigation and asset recovery. Those are handled really in-house in SIU, between the SIU and the special tribunal. Then we have the administrative referrals. Those are primarily for blacklisting, but not exclusively, of suppliers. Then there are the disciplinary referrals to accounting officers. And then finally, there's a category of systemic recommendations, which are much like the type of recommendations that the Auditor General would make in order to future-proof against existing challenges. So the second focus area of the implementation activities is building an actual monitoring and coordination tool. So this is a digital tool, a digital platform, and we are in the process of developing what is termed an initial minimum viable product. So again, the approach that we're taking is not to design a Rolls-Royce off-site and try to move it into and discover that the garage is much too small for the Rolls-Royce. We are iterating and building steadily versions that will enhance the capability. And the third area of focus is around data governance and data structures. This is a critical and often overlooked component. It's located at an administrative and clerical level, but it is the do or die of any system. There's the term GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. Unless you have good quality data structures, data organizations, you're not going to get quality information out of any system, regardless of how much you've invested in it. And then finally, in order to enable this, there's the engagements between the multiple stakeholders that are necessary to build this system. So there's a strong emphasis on the people side of an institutional side. So we have a two-phased, we've completed our concept phase, which is what we reported to the committee in June. We were just wrapping up that first phase, which really was understanding the ecosystem in which we were trying to produce value. We're now in the second phase, which we've termed the pilot phase. This will run until August this year, which we are really now working with the learnings and lessons of the concept phase with the stakeholders to implement a first generation of an automated system. I will now move to the envisioned architecture and that we are aiming for. This slide that you have in front of you, this diagram, presents the almost the vision statement of this the system as we currently conceptualize it. You will see that we have in the center, that central wheel is the coordinating and monitoring digital platform. It is interfacing with systems for each of the types of referrals that I mentioned earlier. So for example, this system interfaces with the National Prosecuting Authority's data system. We will be building what we term, what are termed as IT APIs, which talk to protocol interfaces. So it's basically software that allows you to translate from one database to another. And so we are looking at working with National Prosecuting Authority, DPCI, National Treasury, DPSA, which has their Technical Assistance Unit, COGTA, as well as obviously the SIU. So it's a distributed system that will not attempt to centralize data, but will attempt to coordinate and synthesize where appropriate. So we're not looking at a system that will attempt to migrate all of these data processes into the presidency DPME environment. This will be a light system that is interfacing with functioning systems in the appropriate operating environment. So I think, in terms of our desired outcomes, we're aiming for effective implementation of the referrals, noting that it's an ecosystem that will deliver implementation. It's not a single institution. We're looking at a seamless capability to report so that we can use this information as management information, not necessarily just compliance, but actually for improving the results, the accountability, and the implementation. And then deliver a visible and positive impact as a result of rigorous implementation through monitoring and unblocking challenges. Reliable and consistent source of information, and then effective utilization of the data for decision making. If I can move to the conclusion, Minister. So, the project to establish this SIU referrals coordinating and monitoring mechanism is now in its second phase. Progress has been made in laying the foundations for system integration with developments such as improved administrative systems for handling reports within the presidency, the implementation as of April 1, so the new financial year, of a universal reference number to track SIU referrals across all of the implementing environments. So that has expression in the MRU for criminal referrals. We're working with DPSA and COGTA and DPE as well for the disciplinary referrals. This creation of the centralized register for dismissals across all spheres of government. You will know that national and provincial government departments are on PERSOL, but local government, municipalities and public companies are not on PERSOL, so we're looking at mechanisms to ensure that you can't jump from one to the other undetected if you've been dismissed. Similarly, if you've resigned to avoid a disciplinary process, we are looking at mechanisms to ensure that if you rejoin the public service, that disciplinary process is re-established. So the next 6 months is focusing on developing a working data and technology platform for the first generation automated CMM, as we call it. So hopefully when we come back to the committee, we will be able to demonstrate that system, which is expected to deliver a step change in our ability to monitor and report on progress. It's a lot of effort, but once that system is built, it should deliver a huge value. And so this piloting, this development work around the technology is done in tandem and through a consequential to this continued stakeholder engagement to identify blockages and address them for implementation of the SIU referral. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think that's an attempt, Honourable Chair, to there's a narrative on that slide which Tim presented, which has about four pillars, which speaks to the process construction. Building processes and a digital design for processes, data connection, and ultimately leading to multi-stakeholder interface. And he already articulated key areas of referrals. The attempt here is to say the minimum the state should be able to do is to lay elements and incidents of criminality, lay them bare, so that there is no institution that can have an excuse for not dealing with criminality. And we do hope, Chair, that I've not discussed this with the team, that if this could be a societal integration, not just intra-government, because these people who run away from TC processes and get involved in other institutions land up in court. My ideal dream is that I wish a situation where X who runs away from the state, if you get prosecuted for whatever thing somewhere, automatically your information of your all offenses is automatically downloaded, so that you lay bare the entire information about individuals, both positive and negative. The late Minister Tolaramu would have said one day, he said, criminals need certainty that they will be found, they will be arrested, there will be sanctions. Thank you very much, Chair. Right,
thank you very much, Minister and your team. HOU, are there any comments on your side on what has been presented before we go to questions? Right, Honourable Van Minen has an apology, so we'll start with her, and then we'll come to the other colleagues. Honourable Van Minen.
Thank you very much, Chair. There were some answers towards the end regarding the task team that's being put together, but essentially, if you could please expand on the central register for dismissals and resignations during disciplinary processes. I mean, this is something we've discussed over the years several times, and I realize that it really is a huge problem, particularly, you know, people who then resign and pop up somewhere else. I do understand in terms of a database ecosystem that is being built that that is in process, but related to that, I mean, we've had a presentation on this before. How much progress has actually taken place since that, I can't remember the exact date, I think it was last year sometime, and now, because obviously that's a very, very pertinent issue. Then, talking about the referrals for internal disciplinaries, I see the numbers that are presented, but what, I don't know if you'll be able to give it to me now, but what is happening around the percentages that you might be seeing for those referrals actually becoming disciplinaries, which is probably very badly phrased. What I mean is, it's good and well to have a referral for a disciplinary, but in terms of the departmental breakdowns, what is the percentage in those departments? Do you see that there is a department that does better than others in that regard? So that is just one issue. The blacklisting, is the blacklisting across the board, not just for the entity that blacklists? If I could just expand on that. So, for example, the ESCOM is blacklisting people. Is that something that then pops up when other departments are looking at, for example, the same provider? Then something that concerns me, the criminal referrals and the fusion centre. Now, we've also heard from the EPP a lot about the fusion centre. But just doing some very rough math here, it appears that of the referrals to date, it looks like only about 13 to 14% are actually at this point having finality. I realize that a lot more are in progress, but that does seem like a very low number. And what I'm subtly hearing is there seems to be some kind of disconnect or miscommunication or administrative competition, whatever one wants to call it, between the role players. So there now is an MOU, but it still seems that there isn't a smooth flow of information between the entities. If you could also just talk to that, because, I mean, that is something that one really does have to get out of the way. One can't afford to have people sort of guarding their patch when it doesn't result in a positive result going forward, particularly given the, you know, the cost in time and money of the fusion centre. One wants to see a more seamless interaction. Okay, thanks.
Very much. Let's get responses to that. I don't see hands written. Oh, okay.
All right, let's get these responses, and then we'll come to Honorable Mende, and then we'll go. We respond to a number.
Yes.
But we avoid questions lost. We become inclined to think that it will come at one.
All right.
Cherry picking. All right. Maybe, just quickly, maybe the general comment I want to make sure is that to Honorable.
1 minute.
My apology. Is that we're building a system that is a young age. The biggest thing now, we're not happy with that percentage of performance, but at least we know that percentage now. That's the most important deliverer in it. And even the MOU is at its early stage. The fact that it's now together, at least we're happy. Those are phase one achievements as far as we're concerned. But that phase one achievement, that early stage, exposes the weaknesses that you are to call. But I'll ask maybe Jonathan to stay in the central register first.
Thank you. Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Honorable Van Minnen. So the central register project is one of the actions committed to by the President in his response to the State Country Commission findings. As the report indicates, a task team has been established. It's made up of the key departments. The aim by April is to have established the central register. And to leverage the legislation under the Palmer Act for the Minister of Public Service and Administration to issue directives with regard to using that information in terms of appointment processes. We've got two focus areas of this task team. The first is creating the central register, looking at all of the legalities around publishing. There is an existing system on the DPSA, in the DPSA environment, which allows you to check whether a public servant is a public servant using an ID number or a postal number. So that is, we're going to leverage that system. Postal does collect already the information with regard to dismissals, but there are, however, some challenges in certain departments. Postal is primarily a payroll system as it exists in government, but it does have the capability, does have additional capabilities as old as it is. But that requires the HR functions as opposed to the finance functions to engage with Postal. So some of those require sort of administrative rejigging within departments. But Postal is a very good source of this data. It does flag anyone who's been dismissed. So the fundamentals are in place, particularly for the national and provincial spheres of government. The local government is a more complex environment, you would appreciate. But we have COGTA on board. They do maintain a register of officials dismissed from local government. Similarly, the state-owned enterprises, state-owned companies, Treasury is our point between Treasury and public enterprises, although public enterprises doesn't have the full range, but the big entities. So between National Treasury's ability to access all state-owned companies, we're looking at the modalities of how to ensure that, for example, if someone resigns from a state-owned company, we're aware of that. The easy part is making all parts of all organs of state aware of dismissals from national and provincial. The hard part is gathering from the very distributed parts of the system. So that would be probably less easily achieved. But by April, we will have the central register of everyone who's been dismissed. And then we're also looking at the question of resignations. What we've seen from our analysis, say for example of the PPE, the R23 of 2020, you had 17 officials resigning during disciplinary processes. Now, the the ability exists in law and policy to, if an official resigns, when they join a new department, that new department can reinstate that disciplinary process. But so that requires administrative issuing of instructions and regulations and ensure and monitoring. So those are the kinds of interventions that we are working to have in place in the next financial year, early in the next financial year.
Thank you, Minister, and thank you to Honourable Member for the question. I think just 2 points to add. Around the register, yes, it talks to dismissals, but also there's one fundamental weakness that we want to deal with through FOSAD is the tenure for suspensions, because we know that sometimes officials, they get suspended for long. And that is something that, again, the system will be assisting us now to track and to clean. Because in the current report, as per the presentation indicates, you have a number of officials that have been suspended, but for different tenures. And so sometimes it's to get to the accounting officers, to get you to understand that why would an official be on suspension for 2 years or more, you know. So that is one part of the challenge, but then also the intervention that the system will deal with. And then in terms of just to expand also on the issue of the blacklist, so the ideal state is that we need also to communicate the decision once a supplier is on the register, that there's a communication because the blacklist should not happen in a corner. It must be communicated. It must be communicated publicly so that even those departments that were not aware or even other entities, they are not aware. And they are aware that now that is an untouched service provider. But I think also it's going to take us to develop proper public and private partnerships, because it is not only the responsibility of government to be able to deter such suppliers to be used. So it's this kind of what Minister was talking about, that bringing the whole of society, the private sector as well, to be aware that this is an entity that is involved in malfeasance and therefore they should not also be doing business with. So that is how ultimately we would want the system to assist us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. And again, the general point is that while the entire society of government is integrated, you begin to have an agile society in its entirety. And then it also helps us as we interact with other countries to stay at pace in terms of whatever relationships we have. We don't stay behind because of the static nature in which you manage information. Thanks, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mende. Honourable Fanning, and I find Honourable Mende.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to firstly get an indication from the Minister. Do we still have MNEs in provinces? The provincial MNEs?
Yes.
Thank you.
Although coordination and integration is still a huge challenge across
the dialogue.
My apologies.
No, Chair, I just wanted to
say
that.
The question is looking at me.
Yeah, look at that.
Thank you, Chair. Now, Chair, the first question for me is, building up on what Honourable Van Minen has asked regarding the blacklisting of companies. One, there's an indication or an explanation given to us that there's some form of a communication back and forth between the entities and the service providers to check if they can be blacklisted and whatsoever. I think the team of Babum TV will agree with me that when they are investigating people and they build a case which ultimately convinces them that that particular supplier has stolen the money of the state, they are in full interaction with the documents and that particular supplier through investigation, provision of documentation and everything. And ultimately, when the outcome is communicated, everyone knows that this is where I stand with the law in respect of me being a service provider to the state. Thus, once there is an outcome, it means that that particular person, when they are not satisfied with the outcome, or they want to challenge it, there's a provision within the law to challenge it. Why are you finding it your job to start asking them that, why are you not challenging it? Because that's precisely what you are doing. When you are asking them, should you be blacklisted, explain. There is a law enforcement SIU report which is giving facts. Otherwise, we are rendering the SIU useless. That's what we're doing. Once the SIU is convinced and gives an outcome, we cannot go back to the very same person the SIU says, you have stolen the money of the state, and therefore, according to this investigation and the facts and the proof before us, we agree that when you are not fit to do business with the state anymore. But then a department still goes back to say, can you explain if we can remove you? It's wrong. It shouldn't be. That service provider has a provision within the law. If they want to go and challenge the outcome of the SIU, it's up to them. But there can be a process initiated by the very same state to see, because at the end of the day, Minister, there's going to be, Esh Mkhaya, you know what, Mkhaya, when are you full time? So we'll find a way of you paying it back, some kind of money, but we'll still keep you in the data system. You don't have a mechanism to detect if that which you are trying to do is going to be done diligently and honestly. It's not going to be done like that. So the SIU is the only mechanism we have as government to investigate the people whom we think are not doing good in supplying us, and whatever we pay them, we feel is not worth it. That's number one, Chair. Number two is the blocking. I think I didn't understand it properly, the blocking and the restriction. That one is very problematic, Chair. You will remember the case of Eskom. Yeah, Eskom has blocked some. But let me tell you, Minister, at Eskom, when we deal with Eskom in terms of blacklisting companies, there are companies that they are refusing to remove, yet the very same companies are even paying back some of the money that were paid to them, unduly benefiting. But they are still keeping them in the data. Now the question becomes, who gets blocked? Who gets restricted? Who gets blacklisted altogether? One of those companies is those four companies that were paid by Eskom, but ABB is still in the data with some flimsy explanation of the work they must finish and whatsoever. It means that Eskom is going to continue paying, but the very same Eskom is agreeing that these people have connived with some of our officials and they fixed the prices, inflated some, and now they are paying back the money, but we're still keeping them in the system. What are we doing? So the blocking and the restriction is also very, for me, it is a very gray area. Unless then there is a mechanism in which you assess the levels of, this is the level of corruption here. This is the level of, extreme level of corruption here. Therefore, this one is non-negotiable, must go. This one, we can work with it. There was a fault here and there, or misunderstandings or whatsoever. But there are cases like this one of Eskom where four companies received money that they were not supposed to receive. Others removed but one remains. What do we do? Then on the jumping ship of officials, it goes back to Chair, to that question I asked, do we still have the MNEs in provinces? The explanation is that some people will be suspended for too long. In particular, this tendency goes especially with those that are in contracts with the state, high-level officials. They will be on suspension until their contract is finished and then they go anyway. But even though there is no system in place, I cannot accept an explanation that even the province does not keep the diary. When you disseminate work, you follow it up. Therefore, it means that in provinces, there is no keeping in check with the data they are disseminating to the other spheres of government in terms of the cases. Because you can't have a person being suspended for a period of 6 months to a year without being checked, and then at a later stage you will blame the system. But we have people that are supposed to be feeding the national office of such information, and we pick it up only when Parliament is calling, we need accountability in this area, and therefore now we're going to come and have an explanation. That on its own cannot be acceptable. So what is the duty of the people of the MNEs in provinces if they can miss such information? Because on a daily basis, with a number of municipalities, you cannot miss to check all municipalities in a period of a week on all the work that each municipality has to be doing. But secondly, likely it was touched on the matter of the law that is governing staff members of the state, where you leave one department, go to the next department, your DC can be reactivated and all of that. But Babu Mtivi, I think he is going to find a way of finding a member here to raise. We just had a very good study tour where we learned that even a person is not allowed to resign during investigation. We should not allow them to resign. They can't be resigning. So if there is no provision within the legislation for people not to be allowed to resign, I know the SIU can challenge the pension, freeze it until the case is finalized. So all these tools should be made available, and all these tools should be utilized, because the main reason why everyone resigns is to get access of the pension, leave the state. By the time the case is concluded, there's nothing we can take from that person. Even the asset forfeiture unit will go for a Toyota Tez, that's there somewhere, but get nothing. So in terms of the law, have you identified all the areas that must be fixed in order for the system to be watertight? Because we can have the system, but if the system still allows a person to resign, and then with that very system, it's not going to be supervising if people are getting their pension. The pension must be there on the system. Every time there's an attempt to withdraw the pension, it must indicate on the system through EPF or whichever for municipalities that there's an attempt here to get the pension, and the pension must be frozen until the case is concluded. It can't just be the matter of the DC will follow you. The DC is nothing. Now, coming to the DC, I'm not satisfied, DDG. The outcomes of these DCs, I don't know if you do have a tool within which you monitor the outcomes of these DCs, because once the SIU investigate a person, one, it doesn't investigate them as a group. It investigates them as individuals. So when it makes a referral, it makes a referral purely because there is solid proof that that person has transgressed. But for a person to get a written warning, so why would an SIU waste money of the state for a written warning? I'm sure also they also have a checklist of, is it worth to follow someone who's stolen 1,000 rand and use 20,000 of state resources? I'm sure they don't do that. But they do it purely because it's worth being followed. And it can cripple the systems of the state if it's not dealt with. So for people to get written warnings being referred by SIU, at what level or what kind of cases are people getting written warnings and some get dismissed, but some get suspended without pay? We may take that, but to get a written warning from an SIU referral, then there's a problem. So we must get to check. Do you have a system where you check? A person getting a written, final written warning? What case was it? It may happen that myself and minister, we both stole 10 million, but I get a written warning because nonsensical you to municipality, and then Mina no mayor were buddies. So the DC from the mayoral office knows me, we can work things out. I go out with a final warning. Do we have a scope in which we use to monitor, or a tool we use to monitor who's who? Thank you, Chair.
Alright. I know that it's 1-1, but Honorable Hadebe has got JSCI at 11. Can I just crave your indulgence to cluster the questions so that you can be able to ask them and you'll be excused to go? And I don't get responses. Sorry about that. So it's just made a special request. Right, Honorable Hateng.
You need your
appeals.
I didn't hear that part.
Not that.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Chair, and thank you for your consideration, Chair. My apology for arriving late. I had forwarded my apology. I was the intention for us to be here, Chair, was to ascertain how are these reports being processed and the progress to date. In some of the slides, it fell short to give us a sense so that we understand what is exactly happening here. For an example, on slide 9, the reports that have been received since our last engagement, there are 14 of those, Chair. And out of that, there are reports that have already been issued as final. Some of those reports, they...
Can you slide before that, please?
Yeah, slide number 9. If I were to give you an example, there's a report that has been finalized on the 9th of June 2022. Now, it's more than 8 months down the line. Ours was to get a sense what happened to that report. We are interested in understanding progress. The following report, which became first final and the second final, issued on the 15th of the July 2022, 7 months later. We need that type of information for us to be able to follow up on these reports. What is concerning of us is that there is non-action in terms of reports issued. So, Chair, I'm saying even if it's not now, but the report does not assist us. We understand and fully aware, Chair, about the new monitoring multi-committee that has been established, but things ought to happen now. We can't wait for the finalization of this committee for us to see action. I would be interested to know what happened 8 months down the line about these reports. I can't expect the response that says upon finalization that the multitask team will then see action. That cannot be an answer. There are issues, Chair, again, when it comes to the referrals for blacklisting, 387 have been referred for blacklisting. The report does not tell us to date how many have been blacklisted. This is the same report that was issued to us, I think it's in June, Chair. Sitting here, I do not know, out of that 387, how many have been blacklisted. We raise concern by the time it takes, Chair, to finally arrive at blacklisting. I even said this is a duplication of what the SIU has done. They've investigated and arrived at the conclusion that these companies warrant blacklisting, but an opportunity or another process is created for the various bodies to also conduct another investigation. I'm mindful of the rules of natural justice affording an opportunity, but there is a substantive proof that warrants, and I did not get at that time, I think it was June, the turnaround time for those bodies that are charged with how much time do you give them? You're coming back 8 months down the line, you're still not giving us the exact number of companies that are blacklisted. You are giving us the number of referrals. Clearly something is not right, Chair. We need an update in that aspect. The other question, Chair, okay, which slide is it? Slide number 12. The analysis for referrals for disciplinary action. We are given the number, Tegwini is leading. That's all we're given, Chair. We don't know how many Tegwini has executed out of 75. Like I said, these date back to reports that have been concluded 8 to 6 months. You are only saying now 75 are from Tegwini. How do you ensure that there's movement from that 75? If I were to ask the question, out of 75, how many have been finalized? If that number is too much, at least plan where there's one disciplinary case referred, Northwest, you should be in a position to tell us that case has been concluded, at least. But this report, when we leave here, we won't have a substantive satisfaction whether or not there's movement. You are giving us numbers of things that have been referred, but what we are interested in is an outcome. So please, from cases of two referrals, you should be in a position, because I'm raising this because in your presentation, you have made issues with accounting officers that are giving you challenges. But you are not telling us who are those accounting officers. We need to name and shame. We want them to appear before us. Why have you said with the report 8 months down the line you have not acted? Because Advocate MTV has done its work. The president has been given a report. The president has written to you in terms of the slides. It says, Chair, where is this first slide? I'm going to do a figure late. President issued correspondence to all affected ministers and departments detailing the recommendation by the SIU. And that's what it's on slide 8. You issue, but what is lacking is the culprit. We want to see who are these departments, who are these accounting officers who are failing to act. There's a political party that has declared this year as a year of decisive action. Now we want that decisive action, Minister. We want to name and shame and to call those that are failing to act. It can't be that it's 12 months having requested for you to blacklist ABB and you are still coming back to us with the same number and you are not telling us who's blacklisted. That's not decisive. By decisive action, it must tell us Beg is refusing to act, and these are the reasons. Perhaps if they appear in public, Public Accounts Committee, name and shame, they will act. We can't want reports that Honorable Omisa is saying it's gathering dust. As I close, Chair, there's this on slide, these numbers that are not adding up, Chair, just bear with me. I've made notes. Slide 19. No, it's just slide 19, Mazama. Okay. Mine is on... it's a slide where it talks about 263 PPE referrals and 271 other referrals. If you can assist me, colleagues.
Yeah, you're looking for slide to number 20.
Slide number 20.
Proclamation Article 23, slide 20. Whilst you look for it, can we get responses for the sake of progress?
Yes.
Alright, let's get responses to the questions Honorable Mekde has asked and that first tranche of questions that Honorable Atabe has asked.
In that slide,
you are being informed about, at least as it relates to PPE, at what stage those referrals are being prosecuted, who has been found guilty,
mm-hmm.
emotion, and so on. So at least what you are actually worried about is an attempt to deal with that in slide 30. Let's start quickly. I'll keep on saying this.
Thanks. Sorry, Chair. Can I add on that? So if you add 118 and 65, you arrive at 253. It's 253 individuals. If you add 118 and 65, you arrive at 183. Yes. So there's a remainder of 70.
And the question,
yes, I'm saying there are 253 individuals that have been referred.
Mm.
Now you are giving us a breakdown of that 253, but that breakdown amounts to 183. No, because my understanding is that the June 2022 48 plus 118 is that's an accumulating number. So I don't have to add years. So the only number that I must add is it's the latest, which is December. That's 118 plus 65. It gives me 183. So meaning there's missing 70 where we don't know what's happening with that 456, because it says to date as a result it's 456 referrals.
And Robert, I think you may need to reread that slide because
okay,
I see it one as an extra 2. I think it's because of how it's on the page. The categories are different. So on the left, you don't have dismissals, on the right you do. There's guilties and demotions. Resigned before. I just think how it's
not Chair, I, what I thought is that these are all the breakdowns. If they had okay.
I think they will clarify it though. I think it's the layout that may cause the reading. Okay.
All right.
The issue on slide 13, let's get the response. that will be responded to, Chair. Maybe quickly, one must say, Chair, again, it will be like a stress record, maybe coming across as being defensive. We're saying, if you were to compare the type of information now with regard to interventions and with what was actually occurring prior to this situation, you will find that there's a huge move from how we've been doing things. But what are you asking for, Honourable Member, is how effective? And that is a question that we need to deal with, which I'm saying slide 13 is trying to deal with that, not as comprehensive as you are raising the issue. Because your point is that when we come back, we need to be detailed on the stage of each referral. In one way or another, but the officials are going to respond to that. I just wanted to say quickly, in an attempt to deal with some of the issues that Honourable Mente said, that I think the question we're confronted with is organizing this information in the manner it is being done. As I said, it's laying bare a lot of things, whether it's inconsistencies between institutions, whether it's illegal discretion that institutions are exercising, whether application of the law, the first stage is exposing that so that we're able to come to a point where we say, where are we failing in terms of consistency, in terms of the law? Because what SIU does, they make findings. And then once those findings are there, you categorize them, whether it's administrative, whether it's criminal or disciplinary. And then as you subject them, remember the administrative, a number of them outside the state, it's either you deal with accountants, the profession and so on. Of course, there are those that are within the state. They've got their own different rules. But I think the question what Honourable Mende is worried about is that when the finding, SIU most of the time, would have dealt with the systemic failures. It depends on the nature of the finding. The nature of the finding may be, so has got this fault around himself, it's a systemic failure, or it's what kind of a failure, whether it falls under blacklisting or not. But all I'm saying is that it gives us an opportunity to analyze the policy consistency. And I think your cry is that once a certain work has been done, it must be easy to take certain decisions. And I'm saying what you are calling us to do is to actually move decisively on the consistency of applying the law. The issues of due diligence by individuals. I'll give you an example. As you were speaking, I was using the word consistency. Consistency of the process, consistency of the policy application, whether the system has got trivial capabilities. Like, for instance, somebody is charged in another department for a similar case, and that person is actually sanctioned differently as compared to the same function in as far as other. All those issues are issues of feeding into the system, the reviewal capabilities and so on. I think those are the issues that Mr. Kim and others are going to have to respond to. Of course, Honorable Hadebe is making a huge challenge. You have referred so much. This is what Honourable Member Van Minen was saying, 13% performance. We would have answered that question to say we are organizing ourselves to manage information properly so that we can do follow-ups. I want to accept that one of the reasons we come to present here is for you to be able to punch those, what you call, those holes. But there are questions that must be answered by officials quickly, and then we move, Tim.
Thank you, Minister. I think to respond to the issue raised by Honourable Mente around the frustration that, you know, SIU has made findings against a supplier and then there's this whole process that, needs to be followed. These are this is the legal framework under which the blacklisting. There's two pathways. One is there's two registers. The default tender is list where there's a court order is made to place a particular supplier. That's one area. We also seeing how we can engage with the National Prosecutorial Services to make sure that prosecutors are aware that in the judgments they seek, that they should get the court to order that a supplier is put on the tender defaulters list, although the requirements are very narrow. Then there's the restricted suppliers list, which National Treasury runs both of these, the default tender list and the restricted suppliers. The restricted suppliers list is an administrative process. That gives the authority to the accounting officer to make a recommendation. So that's why there's this very tedious process whereby SIU makes a referral to an accounting officer, provides the evidence for blacklisting. The accounting officer then embarks on a process, as we've spoken about natural justice, to get feedback as to why they shouldn't be restricted. The accounting officer, based on that, giving them the opportunity, will then make a recommendation to National Treasury. National Treasury will then review that recommendation and make a final decision and place a supplier on the restricted supplies list. To answer your question, the restricted supplies list applies to all government departments. So if you're on the restricted supplies list for a case with Eskom, you can't do business with other departments. It's restricted to do business with government. I think to move to the points around, in terms of the review of the PFMA, Treasury are looking at authority to be able to blacklist where accounting officers have not acted. You can see the risk is if there's collusion between suppliers and accounting officers, you have the risk of this thing being played out. It requires accounting officers to act with integrity, and when you see some of our findings, what is emerging from our findings is that there are certain institutions that are really seemingly dragging their feet around this, and which raises additional questions. And the role of the committee is really critical to this mechanism, being able to call, based on the evidence that we can provide, to call accounting officers to explain. On the question of the analysis in terms of the suspensions and the sanctions versus the charge of disciplinary, I think that's a really useful and important piece of analysis that we need to do, which is to look at what the charge is and against the sanction, and then start to do the analysis of where there are discrepancies. That we are, as we build this system, that capability will become available. I think it's a really critical piece of analysis.
The renewal capability of the system.
Yeah.
I think the spot Honourable Mente is putting the whole process in is that there must be set standards on how to deal with certain things. For instance, if the standards are clear in the system, you know that once SIU makes a finding, you test this against the system, and the system must be able to say automatically, this person is what you call, is blacklisted, and also limit discretion by individuals to prolong executing those things. I think those are the teething issues that we actually need to get close to as we deal with the system. Are you done? Okay.
Thank you, Minister. I want to pick up on that point. Minister makes a valid point that the recommendations by SIU are made on a specific finding. And the finding is based on the investigations collected during the investigation. So if anybody is not happy with this finding, must challenge us in court. Now, this finding is used to make the recommendation for blacklisting. Okay? Now,
what minister is saying, we have observed it as well, that there's a whole lot of dragging of feet in the system, and I think it's really because it's not really closely monitored. We've raised it with the National Treasury. Honourable Beggy, Honourable Khadeva makes a point of what is the turnaround time. I think it's something that we really need to go back to say, you know, what is really the reasonable time to ensure that an entity is blacklisted. The other point, which I think Scopa raised before, was the issue of companies versus directors. Because if we blacklist the company, the directors have a tendency of, you know, leaving that entity and then going to form another one. We have, at least from a finding point of view, we now will have to make finding against the company and the directors, and then make recommendations against, you know, both company and directors. So, Honourable Mente, I think you're right. If the company is not happy with the finding itself, we expect them to challenge us. And to date, there hasn't been any. So the issue is from the referral to the accounting authority and ultimately to the treasury. I think it requires some tightening and monitoring there. Maybe while I'm on the platform with your permission, Chair and Minister and members, Minister makes a point around, the Minister have called it illegal discretion. You know, if you look at slide number 13, or if you call up slide 13, there's a point there around number of disciplinary matters that have, you know, that have been dismissed. You know, I've really never heard of that kind of a thing in a disciplinary process. You know, so this is probably instances, and it probably could be a terminology. This is probably instances where the accounting officers have looked at this and said, no, there's no case, I'm not going to discipline. We've had a few of those in some of the municipalities. And so the point I'm really trying to make is that the system should probably evolve to an extent where the value add is that we receive this, and we say, no, man, let's look at each of this, you know, and then we go back to the state institutions and we say, on what basis have you not disciplined? But because we believe we gave you evidence. Honorable Chair, Honorable Members and Minister, we've seen instances where cases are disposed of without calling our members to come and testify. And then we get surprised and said, no, how do you finalize a case when witnesses have not been called? So as I say, the system is probably evolving, but it should evolve to an extent where if there are these results, then the system must interrogate these results. Similarly to the referrals for prosecution, if you look at slide 19, right, where there has been about I think 272 decisions not to prosecute. The same principle applies. We respect the NPA's, you know, responsibility to decide, but we have said, and this will be part of the MOU, where we engage with them and say, you know, what would have been the basis for not prosecuting and so on, so that we close the loops. So I see the system evolving to that extent, Minister and Chair. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. I think, Honourable Atabe, I think you, before you go, you must get your clarity on slide 13.
Yes.
Because I think you, on reflection and in reading it against the previous slide report 10. Of last year,
mm-hmm.
you are quite right. There's a discrepancy on that slide. But can you just speak to it? Because if you read it against last year's report, on these same matches, begin to see the challenge. Right, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. So the elements that we have in this slide are referrals. So there's the 456 referrals to accounting officers. There can be more than one referral against the individual. So when we do the analysis for referrals and then we look at unique individuals, there's a total of 253 individuals that are implicated by the referrals from this particular investigation report. So this is from the December report.
Yes.
Then we say of those 253 individuals facing disciplinary referrals, there have been 118 by December finalized cases. So that number 118, it can't be. It's not a sum of any other number. It's just saying we've got 456 referrals. These are affecting 253 individuals, and of those referrals, and affecting individuals, we have 118 finalized cases against individuals. So they would be cases. Cases would match individuals, but it's not going to add up to 253 because only 118 have been finalized. So the tables below are only looking at finalized cases. So that means that if you subtract 118 from 253, you will get the number of cases that have not been finalized. So the tables at the bottom of this slide are only dealing with finalized cases. What you can see from June to December, if you take the left-hand table and you look at the right-hand columns with the breakdown of finalized cases, you see from June to December progress made in terms of finalizing cases. So when we came to in June, only 48 cases had been finalized. In December, 118 cases had been finalized. Then on the right-hand side, we have a table that describes of those 65 guilty verdicts, what were the sanctions issued? So we had dismissal, and I think Advocate Motibi, it's not case dismissed, it's dismissal of the official. So we had five officials dismissed as a result of this disciplinary action in June when we came to report to the committee, and then in December there were nine. So four additional officials were dismissed. Similarly, those categories below. So we can't really add, it's not apples and apples. Yeah.
Yeah, but maybe then it should be apples and apples.
But
for the purposes of clarity,
maybe Chair. Maybe Chair. I think you're calling for reorganization of information in a manner that kills this question going forward. Because if it's individuals and a number of cases, you might find that from 253 you've got 455 cases that come out of 253. So you need to organize in such a manner that that question is easily answered up front before it is actually... I think the question is not the wrongness of what is here, but it is clarity. Yeah.
Okay. Let's say apples and apples for the purposes of clarity.
No, it's fine.
All right. All right. All right.
It's okay.
All right. Honorable Swart, stand by, and then Honorable Son, Mazamba, don't be the last one. No, no, proceed. I'm just lining them up.
No, can you want to tell us some issues?
No, thanks, Minister. No, actually, I'm covered by both Advocate Motibi and Jonathan. Just one point that I thought also maybe to underscore Honorable Mende around the distinction between to block and to restrict. The accounting officers or National Treasury, they will block while there's still some investigation going. And the essence for that as well is that we don't want you to continue performing business with an entity when we know that there's something, but we can't put our finger on it. And actually it speaks also to the point that Advocate Motibi was talking around, that the whole issue around NPA deciding to take 272 cases not any further, because their argument is that this, they are not prosecutable. We don't see the prospects of success in court. But the discussion doesn't end there, because now we need to analyze from what point are they saying this, and then what happens to those cases once NPA says this. Can we refer them for further investigation if they say the evidence is weak? Can we go and reopen with the SIU in terms of those investigations or the part of the evidence that is deemed not prosecutable or weak? And can we also refer further to the Hawks for investigation. So there's still quite a lot that needs to be done, because as we unpack the problem, as we say, we also want to build what would be a proper solution. And I think the other point that I wanted to mention is that indeed the issue of looking at withholding pension payout, as a matter of fact, in terms of the with DPSA, it is something that we said we needed to be strengthened any further, because when you look at the Pension Fund Act and what the Act says in terms of to what extent can the employer attach the pension of an employee, because that the law has always seen it as the last means of resort for an official, and vis-a-vis people who perpetrate malfeasance knowing that they've got protection of the law on the far end. So again, it's now looking at the gaps within various legislation and to say how do you do this review that Minister talked about, and then what areas you're trying to strengthen. But your point is profound, because even in the presentation I did say that the issue of having conversations with the suppliers, it sometimes raises issues that there's no seriousness. But again, you don't want to run the risk of losing a good case just because on process you faulted. But those are good points that we are going to take forward, Minister. Thank you.
And as we move to your chair, I thought it is important to restate the fact that I repeat that what Mr. Honourable Mendes put the spot on, is that Jonathan, Tim, the team's vulnerability, the system's vulnerabilities must be tested for consistency, for illegal discretion, for abuse. Actually, the system must be of such a manner that it takes us away from the crisis we find ourselves in now, so that there's consistency, and then it's got a renewal capability in terms of the people who actually abuse it. I think that's a fundamental statement in terms of looking at the vulnerabilities, and I think you're doing that, and I thought it's important to restate that, so that when you come back, we must keep an idea what route we follow. Thanks,
Chair. We'll come back to that slide. Right, Honourable Swartz, and then Honourable Sommer.
Chair, there was one question. In the form of a request, that the information given is not aligned to any report. For an example, there were 14 reports that have been finalized, but when you give us the cases, it's difficult for us to track whether that 65 is it KZN. There are more than 40 departments. So in the future,
we'll come back to that, because I've noted it in so far as a comparison of the previous report,
and including those accounting officers that are failing. Thank you.
Okay, we'll come to that. Honourable Spots.
In hand.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Chair, I think mine was also going to be on the reports that we get told when they are saying that the report is interim, it's final. If it's interim, what are the reasons? How did it get to final? So that at least we are also on the same page with this report on final and interim, and no referrals, but without reason to us in terms of how it reached that stage. Chair, on slide 12, there are cases which have been referred for disciplinary action. How does the presidency ensure that action has been taken? Do they follow up if consequence management has been taken after referrals? On slide 12, there are cases which have been referred for disciplinary action. How does the presidency ensure that action has been taken? Do they follow up if consequence management has been taken after referrals? It is also concerning, Chair, that the SIU issues recommendations only. So what happens after those recommendations have been made? How do they ensure that the disciplinary action taken is the appropriate one for that misconduct? In most cases that SCOPA has dealt with, there's been malicious compliance. And Chair, I think also that we've been forever talking with Advocate Matibi around Treasury actually publishing blacklisted companies, because they don't. The SIU does its work, it recommends, they will tell you company X is blacklisted, but you can't actually go on Treasury's website and go and pinpoint a company that this company is blacklisted. Also, with the new digitization system coming in, I have an interest how DTI is going to come on board. Because if we are now talking that we are, Advocate Matibi is saying that our interest is not only on the company, but on individual directors as well, so that they do not register another company. So how is DTI going to come on board here? Because that is where the whole issue starts, where individuals go and register companies. Is their IDs and names going to be blacklisted at DTI so that they do not register companies? Now also, this is something I think I've raised before also, Chair, when we had IPDI, we had the Hawks, we had Advocate Matibi there, that Minister, we confiscate houses, we confiscate cars to recoup money back. But that does not become enough, because those individuals are still part of control systems which are wrong from everywhere else where they are doing business. Now, that comes to a point where we have accounting officers who are not vetted up until their term ends or they decide they are resigning. And those are practical things we have seen here in Scopa, where we've got big people running, big SOEs who were not vetted, and now they are on their bye-bye month. We are humble next month too, Baba. We did not get a proper report on his vetting was completed, not completed. But as an accounting officer, he's been handling huge amounts of money and running a huge institution. Now, I am saying that as long as we don't have accounting officers and senior managers vetted, this thing will not end. Because they are not vetted, they are doing business. The one we have houses and cars tomorrow, he brings in another company, and because the control systems are what we are dealing with here. It's the control system, it's the people inside in our SOEs. Now, Tom said that, I want to agree with him that if you have officials who are not committed and officials who are not part of a system to say that we are going to deal with proper systems of procurement and deal with corruption, that is going to happen. But equally so, as long as we have senior managers and people in high-profile positions not vetted in time, they do what they want to do, and when they see that trouble is looming, and whether they are not enjoying their work anymore, they can just easily leave. But what they leave behind is a big mess. Now, my last comment, Chair, on the digitization project, which Tim has presented and saying is that it is on phase two. I just have an interest on how much this digitization system is going to cost, and that you are saying phase two is coming up in the new financial year. My question around that is that we have had SOEs coming to sit here and telling us that after doing everything that they've done, all the designs in a particular institution are defected and they are going to start from scratch. Now, I have an interest on this program, this digitization program. You are on phase two. How are you going to pilot it? How are you going to test it so that you don't implement it with the whole money and then you come back here to Scopa and you tell us that one IT person had made a mistake, so you need to redo that, so that we have comfort that what you are implementing, you are not going to come back here and tell us that it had defects and that you are going to rebuy so many data backup machines or whatever, and modems and everything, and you are going to come with a wonderful story that no, room one was supposed to do this, it did not do that, so we are starting from scratch after you have paid and after you have done everything. And I also have an interest in who are the people that are helping you to set up this. Do they have a track record? Has it been done somewhere? Where did you see it for you to come up with this, so that we don't come back here at Scopa and tell us that, no, we dreamt and the dream did not go through. Thank you very much, Chair.
Well, you must understand our discomfort, Minister, comes from the IFMS saga. You're bringing in, you're pulling all sorts of departments together on a digitization project, and we've got a history, unresolved history, in fact, on IFMS. So, yeah, Honorable Swartz is quite good. All right, let's... can we cluster you? I'm just going to manage time. Can we cluster you? Let me cluster with Wapfam, and then Honorable Leith and Honorable Bukas will be the last one. I'm just looking at the time, colleagues.
No, thank you, Chair. I don't want, in dealing with my questions, I don't necessarily want to say what the Minister and his team is coming up with. They're not necessarily useful. It's very useful area, because my realization of what he has brought to us is a development of a matrix for accountability in as far as these investigations are concerned. Something which is very critical to be carried through, though the matrix lacks in certain instances. One as a highlight, if you look into the slides, which I think the DDG has indicated in three forms, probably four, that if you look into the nature of growth in the investigations as captured from 2010 onwards, there are categories which are somewhat permeations which are brought by such a number of those investigations. Looking into the competition commissions driven investigations, and looking into those which are within the SOE and municipalities, their growth somewhat driven by specific instances in terms of time, and those who are emanating from the PPE. Mm-hmm. And all of those, they've got, they capture a moment even in terms of the quantities, quantums, the value which is driven out of those investigations. Something which the metrics, I think the DDG would have, I think she highlighted the fact that if we look into these investigations, there's a necessity to grow that accountability instance into the qualitative nature of such. Something which would be necessary for us to highlight for the value drive in as far as investigations are concerned. Whether we're carrying investigations chasing a fly with a sledgehammer in terms of the quantity aspect, the quality aspect, and how do we get those kind of qualities and values out there. There's necessity probably to build that through. But one thing which then becomes my interest, that out of those competition commission investigations, there were outcomes, that certain amounts must be laid back to the state as the companies involved, the big companies in terms of those state jars which were built and so forth. And where is that money? Where who is responsible for such? And whether indeed the state did get that kind of a rents and cents as they were directed to those companies. What is happening currently with such an amount? And then on the following slide, you see the SIU has reported to us in a number of forms that relate to the proclamations which were somewhat issued. I see here on the highlights in terms of the numbers, in the EC, there's only the Department of Health. Well, not necessarily only, because the OR campus is one there. But was something which was referring to Amadola Water at some stage. I don't know what is happening, where the failure refers to such kind of investigation. Whether is there anything out there, or maybe such matters have been thrown out one way or the other. I think I've referred to the errors of the fire charge and so forth. And Honourable Mende referred to this. You see, and the DG speaks about the DG's responsibility in terms of coordination when these things are referred to the presidency on the FOSA code, through FOSA code, coordinate some of the messages which relate to the finalization of this. It becomes then a bit far less understanding, such that I want to my dictionary to check and note this thing called bureaucracy. Through that, I found out there is emphasis at times on the on lack of efficacy when you follow it, and here you go into the mode of reporting, the mode of harnessing your peers to act in a particular way, because the system is bureaucratic, and through working through that bureaucratic system, you want to harmonize the system. And in harmonizing the system, you'd want them to see acting together. And that persuasion, form of persuasion, is dependent on the accounting officers being able to follow that through in a successful instance. And this is where the problem lies. Because if you have them in one room, and you point to them, here is the system failure. And based on that system failure, you outline your action, because your team is monitoring and evaluation. And monitoring within that system, the impediments would be then to drive effectively, how do you want to break that system to go towards efficacy and ensure that the drive for value, for money, begins to permeate the accountability ecosystem, one way or the other. So maybe going forward in driving these metrics, you would want to see how that could be embedded in a way and see the value in as far as the DG is working, tracking the movement of such, and looking into your own data collection, keeping, and all that stuff, what the chair is referred to, the role of CETA, you see, in this instance, and because in the audit of PPE, the Auditor General emphasizes this point, that the failure of the state at times could be caused by the absence of connectedness, if indeed we're mobilized through that connectedness, other things would not fall through the cracks. That's what is being done currently by Honourable Minister Minister Mosoliti in having thousands of data capturers. And I ask that question, would that data be permeated through the entirety of the system? You see, where you won't have problems for those who claim on the 350, what at the same time that beneficiaries of NSFAS or other beneficiaries from other SASA related. So all those kinds of other than the army, others are in the employ of the state in one way or the other, as an example, you see. So that the state as one, act as one, and defeat the factor which is relating to these failures and what you have stated in terms of the use of personnel, which is itself a limited use in this regard. The purpose of this meeting, at the start of the meeting, was caused by the fact that SRU would say the findings in a particular province, and we have referred this point to that province, we have had interaction with the premier in the province, but has failed to act, on that matter. I think there were matters which are of referrals, which were not acted upon, as an example, in one other province. You have a person who was a HOD in a department, and that person landed in a premier's office, as an involved in a premier's office. Why does the matter cited in the department where this HOD one way or the other? So we felt that, no man, let's convene this kind of a session to see how the presidency would coordinate these forms of outcomes of investigations. And that was one of the driving factors that we must have this kind of a list. The second point was that SRU, you have a myriad of cases finalized, investigated, but there's failure to act on the NPA side. So my way of example would have to be a funnel of some kind, where you have SRU pouring into that funnel, and you have other investigative organs pouring into that funnel, and you find out the narrowness of the endpoint would make it difficult to solidify those outcomes and finalized by SRU to get through the funnel. And where they end, even in the court itself, you find there's a minute number of such instances which end up in the courts. And therefore, in the monitoring and evaluation unit, it would need to be substantive in giving us a report around those matters. Now you're talking about more than 200 instances of those investigations which have been made, and the actual end point, which is the end of the funnel, you'll be talking about less than 50 which have gone through to the courts, and less than 30 which have gone through the finalization by the courts. So your metrics should as well take charge of that form, which says, here's the good work by the SRU, driven by the presidency, through these numbers of investigations. But to the end point, it's far less, and even the outcomes are far less. Unfortunately, the courts are not in our envy to look into them and ask them the question, why is this is happening this way? And the NPA, in this instance, ought to drive those quality of work which ought to go to the courts. So the balance between those becomes very, very critical. So your metrics should as well inform us as to what is happening, at that level, and how do we begin to deal with such in terms of the detail. And then finally, I think Honorable Hajib has dealt with this a kind of it. You know, in the arithmetic form, they what called a unit. You see, in a such a format, which forms what is called a union such. And in the union set, you have several numbers which are collated outside the rings, which meet at some stage. The state has created through the value of seeing the actors in the investigative form contributing into anti-corruption and so forth, an entity which is taking into consideration all those who are contributing into that. But the value substance of that collation ought to be at some stage brought into realization. That such intersection would bring them together, that while they've done this kind of work, 8,000 possible instances are brought in, and only 30 that brings them together as a tie in an intersective form. So that you begin to influence in the monitoring and evaluation space that how at best do we have to affect the efficacy of the state in dealing with these matters. There's value investigation, that value must pour into the outcome, and such outcomes must be celebrated one way or other at the end of it all. So your metrics should talk about those things, though I would want to appreciate the fact that we could take it as a metrics which would grow as you deal with these matters going forward. So thank you very much, Chair.
Right. Let's take Honourable Liz, because Honourable Bukas says she's covered, and then we will just cover all the areas, and then colleagues, you will note if there's anything that falls through the cracks. We come back to it. I hope it would be done by 12:30 latest. Honourable Sonia, the issue raised, we on the judiciary, we continue to have a headache in terms of court management, and I'm not sure how we get around that one, because there's the challenge which we've had, the NPA has raised it and so on. We need to find a way, whether through the Office of the Chief Justice or the Department of Justice, because that in itself ends us up with what we can only call cosmetic prosecutions. A matter sits on the roll for 5-6 years, and what do you gain from it? A conviction must be good, but at the same time, it's a conviction just solely on the basis of compliance, and it starts there and ends there. So it's just an area to look at. Azamban, over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are watching under now, Jenga. Mr. Chairman, I can see that the Red Bull has done its work. So, Mr. Chairman, just in terms of the courts, there are issues there which are probably beyond our purview. But it is the special tribunal which is an important tool in this respect, and I'm sure Andy would confirm that. Mr. Chairman, on a lighter note, I know Becky left, but he was taking issue with the 75 Etegwini disciplinary cases, and his question was, how many have been executed? And I thought, well, that's a bit extreme. I think dismissal would probably
be... I suppose at some point the minister responded to that, and he said that would kill the question, so I don't know. So first execution, I don't know. All right.
And Becky will just have to take the fact that he's not here, and I'm poking fun at him. But Mr. Chairman, this is really a serious meeting, and whilst we need to laugh, laughter is an important factor in our lives, and mitigates against anger too much. So I don't apologise for making us laugh a bit in a very, very serious matter. Mr. Chairman, as Honourable Selmia has pointed out, our emphasis for this meeting was to look at progress on these referrals. And what we've heard a lot about, Minister, is about new systems, changes, and all important stuff. I'm not suggesting it's not important, but not very much about progress. And indeed, I referred earlier to slide 19 and the arithmetic can be checking there, but I can't get a a hold of the numbers. But put that aside, the important number there, to me, is that 272 referrals out of, I think, either 377 or out of 346, I'm not sure out of what total that comes, but let's assume it's the 346, so 79% of the referrals were declined by the NPA. And I assume that's after the Hawks have been involved as well in once the SIUs made their referral. And so to me that seems to be distressingly high number to not be prosecuted. Now, I don't want to point at Andy or anyone else, but who's not doing their job here, or is there a wasting of resources? So I'm not sure. My question to the presidency really is, in something as grossly seemingly inefficient, what has the presidency done to follow up on these 272 cases that haven't been prosecuted, or in fact are not never going to be prosecuted? It's been declined. And I know that there was a comment about those 72 earlier, but I wasn't entirely happy with that. So that's the one question. Mr. Chairman, I'm a little bit confused, but I think I'm clear. But we seem to use the term blacklisting and restricting as two different processes, whereas it seems to me that it's only one process. So I'm not sure why we use two different names for the same thing. It's either blacklisting or it's restricting. Why do we use two different names? I'm sure that people on the street would be quite confused, as I was in the beginning, but I think I'm pretty clear now. The distressing part there is, I think it's been aired by many of my colleagues this morning, all of the colleagues, I think, is the, again, the lack of action by the accounting officers. And so my question then again, Mister, is there a mechanism to follow up on that? These are not big schemes of changing systems and databases. These are referrals. Some, let's say it's 377 referrals. It's not a big job to follow up and say, you know, give us a report. Have these been sent to National Treasury or haven't they been sent? If they haven't, why haven't they been sent? What I'm trying to say, Mr. Chairman, there's some quick wins here to show, following, building on what the Minister said about Dula Ama's quote, people out there need to see what decisive, I forget the words, but I think they were very appropriate and important. So, Mr. Chairman, my last question is, from the SIU does the work in terms of a referral, what is it, not a referral? Coming from the president, yeah. And so when the reports are done, I know we've had difficulty in the past getting access to the report before it's published by the president or in that. But my question really is, ministers, is every single report of the SIU put onto the website and accessible to every South African citizen? I hope it is, but I'm not absolutely sure about it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Can we get responses to that? And then there will be follow-ups where is necessary for us to take these matters forward. The one point, just I'm not going to try and go into for the long list of questions that I have here, but Minister, I would imagine at a particular level, the major stumbling block to the finalization of cases is the rigidity of the labor laws as a major policy area which has to be looked at. I know it may be a hornet's nest now for the union, but are the labor laws conducive for effective and efficient consequence management in whatever form in which it needs to materialize for
the state to be able to move. For example, people are on suspension for 2 years. Why? Because the elements within the labor laws are continuously allowing for these layers and tiers of appeals and so on and so forth. We have to find a way, whilst at the same time protecting the collective rights of the workers, there is the national interest for the state machinery to continue. Because there's monies involved here, there's losses involved here, you've got unfilled vacancies, you've got people acting, and we all know the headache that comes with acting. People tend to be very hambagahle in what they do and do not do because they're not in the positions full time and so on and so forth. So at that broader level, you've got this headache, and I'm just placing it for us to look at how much of an impact does it have on bringing these matters to a logical, labor, legal conclusion. That's point number one. Point number two, Minister, I would want to go to the matter that Honorable Hadebe raised about future reporting against a report. So if there's a dismissal, you've told it this one, right? So that's basic stuff that has to actually happen. Now, I go to the issue of, and Honorable Lees has raised, I think Honorable Somi as well, the MOU, right? In the main, it's supposed to foster the pooling and sharing of resources, so to create a conveyor belt which leads to a successful prosecution, preservation, and the whole nine yards. That's its intention. The fusion center, the anti-corruption task team, as Babu Mtibi would attest, that's what's its intention, right? But then how do we arrive at what Honorable Liz raises of the NPA not prosecuting? Because the whole idea is the SIU comes in to empower the investigation to make sure that when you get to prosecution level, you have, you know, dotted the I's and crossed the T's. And then you've got this high rate of non-prosecution. So it adds a particular discomfort in terms of, and it's a pity the NPA is not here, but it adds a discomfort in terms of the will of the NPA to deal with these things. So that's where my confusion is, because we've heard a lot of things. Anti-corruption task team, fusion center, now there's an MOU, which is supposed to strengthen the investigation process to a successful prosecution. So Honorable Lisa, 79%, right, you say. And then it doesn't happen. So what it does is, it's really amounting to fruitless and wasteful expenditure in so far as the efforts and the resources, financial and human, that the SIU puts into these investigations if they don't arrive at successful prosecutions. I probably we are venturing into spaces which may be well outside our scope, but in order for there to be legitimacy and credibility to the process, which we are embarked upon, was our key question is that if there's an investigation and the report, it must be implemented. And part of the implementation is prosecution. And we're not seeing it happening. So it does raise a particular level of suspicion. We're not moving at the pace that we want to move. My final point, Mr. Minister. There are historic investigations, and I think it is the slide on, I think the DDG did spend a lot of time on this. The historic, trying to find it. Slide 5, yes, the proclamation. So we know now there was no matrix, there was no reporting format, and so it, you know, and the
that's why it's being developed. But the spikes in 2011, 15, and then of course in 16, 17 up to now, it starts. How far back are you going with this matrix to assess what happened to those reports? You've got your 2010 related infrastructure project, the infrastructure built, it was riddled with corruption on a number of levels, right? So you've given us the 2021 and 2022, right? How far back are you going? Because those reports as well can't just be noted as having happened. So you need to take us into confidence about that particular. And then this thing about final and interim. I think let's clarify it. Final for who? Final for SIU having brought a report to you, and then it becomes final for the presidency in implementing. When does it begin and end being interim? When does it begin and end being final? Because when they hand it over to you, there's still a process, right, that you embark upon. So I think you need to make that distinction, that when a report is final, at what level are we referring to that finality? Right, Minister, over to you and your team for responses, and Advocate TV will come in as and when is necessary.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think my team will deal with the technicalities that Honourable Chair raised, especially about the system. She spoke also about loopholes of people registered in different companies. How do you check if the person who is on the wrong side of the law, the system being potentially defective and all those. You guys are going to deal with those. And then, the issue of, she spoke also about the issue of recouping. How much comes to the state? Do we get enough? But you guys must have been listening with that question. She spoke about the cost of the system, and then there's one or two issues before you guys come that are strongly coming out of the committee, is that the value of us as presidents when we come back here is not how much information we know, is the qualitative aspect of our intervention. What are they speaking about is like non-DC, what is the reporting as far as that is concerned? You refer to a DC. Evaluation. In other words, I think in particular, as Honorable Sonia puts it, says we appreciate your AM activities, your monitoring activities. But because your main duty is to work with us on the E aspect of M&E. Now that you know what is happening, qualitatively, how are we moving forward? One of the examples is what Honorable Shlengwe is strongly raising that. Whilst we know that we don't have authority over NPF, what the matrix succeeds to help us to do is to put defects on every issue. Whether you are referring to is an administrative referral, is a criminal referral, the system put all the facts to the back, so that even if us as president we don't do what we're supposed to do, you've got access to that information and be able to say, is it the failure of the president to make a follow up on this one? At least the facts are there. Even if you go to NPA, ICU, we work with them in such a manner that what is referred to the NPA, everyone would know. But we cannot tell NPA what to do. But we will analyze. We have got a right to analyze why are they not protocol. And then the outcome of that analysis may either lead us to say, do we need an amendment of the law? If not, is it the ineffectiveness? Is it the lack of capacity? At least the scoper is entitled to say, as long as you know what has been referred, now we're able to analyze, and we're being called upon to assist that. If MPA has had 72 cases referred to them, they only acted on two. We must be able to come here that, what is our analysis of that? Why do we think they have not prosecuted? Those MOU give us opportunities to engage them and also come with our independent views. And the strongest question that this committee is asking us is we need to give account of our role in as far as E of the MNE is what you call, is concerned. This also goes to prosecution authority. In other words, non-prosecution, non-blacklisting, and then Honorable Shema says, what value is spent on SIU work as against what NPA does? Is it worth the value of the millions spent? Of course, at times you might say $7 billion is returned to the state. That's a significant amount. And then said it's no less than 2 something billion of companies having been, whatever. There's also facts to that. But I think that I want to state the point that we're called upon when we come back, that we must explain our, we must account in as far as is concerned. And then I will allow you guys to deal with all the other technical issues. I'll start with you, Tim, and then come to the chair.
Thank you, Minister. If I can start with questions raised by Honourable Swartz. The final interim, I think, that's how you indicated.
Normally that comes from them. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Normally, SIU, but advocates will explain that. They would say we're giving a recurrent report to the president. We are coming with the final report. But they would explain their better competence.
So just to do the question around how does presidency follow up on disciplinary referrals, we work closely with the technical assistance unit within DPSA that has a legislative mandate to monitor and intervene. They actually have legislative power under PALMA to intervene where accounting officers are not acting. So we are working closely with that unit in terms of tracking referrals as well as following up with consequences. You know, trying to ensure that there are results. I think the big question that emerges here, the so what question.
Yes.
Just on the point about blacklisted companies, not published. They are published on Treasury's website. There's a very useful resource called vulekamali.gov.za that is a kind of interface between Treasury's data and makes it more accessible. And there's the list, you can get it there if you just Google there. So the list is published and updated quarterly, I think. In fact, it's updated as and when there are new companies added. Just on the question of blacklisted versus restricted suppliers, I think that I was wondering why we're using that. But I can see here on Treasury's website, they talk about blacklisted suppliers in reference to the restricted suppliers register. So it's just crept into the parlance. I think the point about directors and DTI is really, again, a value add. As you can see, you know, we're starting with something that's quite rudimentary and small, but potentially, as we engage further, the vision in the future is that it shouldn't, that this information shouldn't necessarily be mediated by presidencies, that a committee like SCOTA should have direct access to this information. And, you know, once we've got credible data, its utility should be available unmediated. Once we're sure that the data is robust and the processes around the data are credible. Cost. I think the point raised about failed IT systems in government, it's so important. We haven't done an evaluation on the state spend on ICT projects, but I think that would be a very important exercise. I think there's a lot around the procurement process that's inefficient in terms of digitizing. There's a term called vendor vultures, where ICT, there's a lot of investment in the ICT business on sales. So you end up buying systems that can't be implemented because you haven't done the necessary groundwork in terms of being able to implement. So you have state-of-the-art system, IT system, but you can't implement it in your current environment. So we've taken this different approach, which is really trying to understand what the problems we're trying to solve are, not what the solution is. Mm-hmm. Because if you start asking for a solution, you're going to get very sophisticated systems being sold to you. The question we are asking is, what is the problem we're trying to solve? And often that is requires a very simple intervention and often non-technical at the start. So we tend to move too quickly to automation where it's actually understanding processes that are not necessarily digital yet. In terms of investments, so we've taken an approach. I think one of the challenges in the procurement system around ICT is you need to know in a quite a developed way what solution you need before you even can really understand the problem. So you end up putting things out to tender and you get solutions that don't solve your problem because you never understood what your problem actually was. So we've taken a different approach. We are using donor funding that DPME is responsible for these inception phases. So we haven't used any public funds on this. The conceptual phase was 500,000. Our phase two budget is 3 million. We don't have a budget for this because we don't want to be in a situation where we are committed beyond this incremental approach. If there's too much money available, I think we'll run into problems. So a lot of the solutions can be delivered in a simple, cost-effective way in the early phases. Once we've got a very clear understanding of what problem we're trying to solve, that's when we need money. But money early on will create unnecessary complexities in this effort. In terms of, I don't know if I've covered enough, Minister, but I can go.
There was a question by one of the sources that understood that if A is blacklisted, running a particular company, which is a different company, how are we protected against that? I'm not sure that was the question.
Yes, it goes to the issue that Honorable Tibi, it's fine.
it's the issue around individuals in companies as directors, and then you blacklist the company, and they come back through a back door. We've raised it before. So the issue we've raised is we get that companies are a legal persona, civil and whatever, liable, the whole nine yards, we get that, the legal entity. But the legal entity is driven by people. Mm-hmm. And so it's people blacklisting that we've been looking at. Am I capturing you correctly?
Yes, Chair, maybe.
I can just add, Chair, that maybe my fundamental question, because I even said that, I referred to Advocate Matibi, that out of the cases that you have prosecuted and even reclaimed money back, can the presidency and SIU and NPA and everybody comfortably tell us that the list of people blacklisted there tallies with what you have? And how do you also check on Treasury that it is blacklisting whoever has been found guilty and is not supposed to do business? Because these are human operated machines, Minister. Yeah.
Thank you, Minister, and thank you, Honourable Members. There were many of the comments that were made that I think Ministers covered, but maybe to start on the issue that Honorable Swart is talking about. What we are doing is cleaning up part of the system of what has already started happening. Department of Public Enterprises, working with the CIPC, they have already started the process of, so they link, a director can actually be disqualified from serving as a director on the basis of the breach of fiduciary duties. and that goes to the CIPC. So now the link that we are bringing in is over and above the director being disqualified, but also you go further, you even wanted to make sure that they will not serve immediately, their name gets flagged the minute they register another company. And also to the professional bodies as well. You know, you want your law societies, your health professional council, and all others, the body that is responsible for accountants, you Zaika. So you want them also to become part of the value chain, so that Matieti Megwa's name should be flagged from all areas, from registering a company, from practicing as a lawyer, and from even being a member of an NPO. So it is the future end state, but the work has already begun, especially the DPE is also addressing that. On the issue of budget, I thought it's also important that we did not want to... we're trying to deal with what in the State Capture Commission of Inquiry was dealt with, that the government always tends to think that solving a problem is to throwing money at it. So we are testing that ourselves by saying we cover this work, phase one and phase two, from our own baseline. And only once the work is done and you can actually see part of the implementation, then we can be able to identify if funding is still going to be required, and if so, what would be the extent of that funding? And as we said, we started with working on donor funding. But there's also a question that was asked around getting to hold the executives in state-owned companies, as well as the DGs accountable. I think honorable members are aware that now the DG in the presidency is the head of the public administration. So we're beginning to, as part of this work, to use that role, because DG is responsible for career incidents of her counterparts, other DGs, but also we want her to use her role as HOPA to bring discipline in the performance agreements of the DGs. So to say now, it's no longer an issue of looking at consequence management. It must cascade right from the DGs, and then it goes down to the junior officials, because the point that the chair was mentioning about the process being protracted and also junior officials being the ones that are always targeted for malfeasance. So we hope that, yes, we clarify her role as the head of public administration, we also bring that accountability and address the issue of bureaucracy as well, because these are the DG. Thank you.
I suppose that's another time you'll explain what you mean having head of a public administration. Don't you have DPSA? I think it requires, at what level is she head of public admin? Just for clarity on our part.
I think that policy has been adopted and pronounced, that now DG in the president is the head of the administration. It means now she supervise, she coordinates, and she's going to create some kind of, maybe we need to come with all the policies here.
Okay.
And give.
That's why I'm flagging it, so that
it's very important.
We should provide the particular clarity in terms of the accountability lines, which is necessary.
What sort of report would you want from her if she's got what responsibility?
Yeah. That's why I was just flagging it. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks, Minister, and certainly, Chair, at the right time, we can engage on that as well. So I think the rest of the other issues really have been covered. I think just one point, Chair, on the rigidity of the existing labour laws. The issue of looking at which aspects of the laws to be amended that are going to be coordinated, but I can see that I have tickled the minister, so he wants to come back on that.
Okay. No, I think it's a very important point. What I want to say, Bishama, is that my experience, especially in national government, I spent time as a mayor in national government, the challenges of the labor relations, instead of
the efficacy of the law. There's a lot of inefficiencies of the people who are to come, who are applying. So greater degrees, not only labor, what to call dispensation, is very progressive. And even if you read judgments, they are hitting us very, very hard. That there's a lot of cases that end up in what to call in court, which could have been dealt internally. There's a lot that are prolonged. For instance, I guess one of the interviews that had been made in the 60 days, what to call suspension, it was an attempt to deal with inefficiencies of applying. I think, what am I trying to say? The challenge we have, I think the president has got a huge task to deal with that, is to analyze the efficiencies of applying the labor relations, which have actually been passed test that is developing a very, very progressive labor relation. I may not be giving the exact answer now, but we may have to come at some stage, even if we come with experts, to analyze what are the weaknesses. But I, with my eyes closed, the huge percentage is inefficient application of the law. Thanks.
Minister, there was a question from the chair about how far back do you want it to go with the implementation of the proclamations and the investigation. Simple answer is all the way back. And as this slide that is on the screen indicates, that we had to deal with the pressure cookers, but also to make sure that you close the floodgates. The system, once it's intact, will go. It will be easy to clean backwards because you will have made sure that we don't repeat the mistakes. So the intent is really to go all the way. Thanks, Chair.
I follow up, Chair. Let's get the advocate.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Honourable Chair and members. Just a quick one on the observation by Honourable Mante. I think Honourable Minister, when you engage DPSA, really this issue around accounting officers refusing resignations, I think at some point it might really need to be tested. Of course, it's going to be tested against the labour laws again. Mm-hmm. You know? But our observation and benchmark in India was that it really works and works very well. On the final and interim reports, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members and Minister, the legislation regulating the work of the SIU says once the President issues the proclamation and the investigation starts, so there's a provision there that at any point the President can call on what the law calls progress report. So that's the rationale behind interim report. But the content of the interim report gives finality to findings that would have been made at that stage. So it doesn't mean that it's actually interim and nothing really tangible gets reported. And that also assists with and as we have done as management, that we need to execute investigations as speedily as expected by SCOPA, by public, and so on. But we took a decision internally and checked with the presidency if it would be acceptable that any investigations that goes beyond a year, and now we've reduced it to 6 months, we need to issue progress reports, interim reports, that is. So in that regard, we are able to at any point indicate to the President where we are and what findings have been made at that stage, which can be actioned, which usually are those findings, as I said before, would be final in their own right. So the interim report is meant for that. Thanks.
And maybe the last point, Chair, is that on the issue of right to resign, there's a lot of legalities, like other continuous conversation. Mm-hmm. There are certain advantages that can be secured during contractual, when you make a contract. Some of those, if you say, for instance, one of the conditions of your employment, if you are found in this situation, these are the obligations. But however, the state will also have certain obligations. You are not allowed to subject people to DC indefinitely. because there are instances where people's DC are not executed for flimsy, what to call reasons. The law does intervene to protect those who are subject of discipline, to say the prolongation must be actually legally justified. So there's a lot of balancing, but the question is, I think the essence is, how do you protect the state against unfair losses of its resources, against individuals who disappear and so on? Thanks.
This one, and then I would like to do the last one.
My last one, Chair, is that if and when we do get the report, as Honorable Peggy as Hadebe has also requested, mine is just to add that after referrals, when you get referrals in the presidency of disciplinary action, who does the follow-ups? It's a team of how many people? How often do they meet or talk to all the relevant bodies after referral? And what can we put on the table in terms of us saying we have so many consequence management that have taken place, so that we have an idea in terms of who does it, is it efficient? Because it's all well and good that the SIU gives the president quarterly reports on interim and she gives him all the reports he wants to know. But for us at SCOPA, at the end of the day, our gripe is always, is consequence management taking place and is it being implemented? Because for us, that's where the question always lies all the time, that consequence management, has it been implemented? Is it taking place, or are we still having a person just sitting there while the person can easily just say in the street, "I'm Meleka president, what is me a case here?" And how long does it take us? Turnaround times.
No, thank you, Chair. Just one minister, this one is for you, most probably the DDG, in identification of the laws that must be amended. Because in developing a system, trying to cap something which is perpetuated and cushioned by the law, needs the law to correct it. So to simply use court outcomes in actual fact speaks to the weaknesses of your existing legislation. So if there's a court outcome that says you cannot just blacklist a person on the basis that the SIU says this, yet the very same person does not review the outcome of the SIU, but still has a room to maneuver a friendship and whatsoever, which may ultimately even change the outcome of the SIU to say, in actual fact, you've done nothing. We're not blacklisting you. So we need to change those laws. So in the next visit, Minister, please, you must come to us with a very good love letter of which laws you are amending. This Parliament, when it ends, Chair, we must have passed those laws. Thank you.
Minister, just on the, I was pulling out my notes here, as at November 2022, there was 305 officials sitting at home on suspension with full pay of 131 million rand. That's at November 20, and that doesn't include defense or the state security agency officials. So it tells you the extent of. Right, let's get reaction to, let me give you, Minister, we will request that you give us monthly reports in writing on these issues, on progress, and now it's the 21st of Feb, so we'll get the first report end of March, and then there will be quarterly appearances on your part. So there will be the monthly reports, and then you will appear once a quarter for us to have an interaction and an engagement on these matters. Second point, maybe in your other head of planning, monitoring and evaluation, unless there are drastic decisions taken about CETA,
I kid you not, none of our dreams, hopes, and aspirations for the future of being a technologically capable state will ever come to light. IFMS is one case. Post office, you remember when we went there, it was a major issue. None of these the Minister of Home Affairs wants to do will meet it. Unless, Minister, you are bold and decisive as government about theatre at this, you know, moment of reckoning about science, technology, and innovation, this country is in trouble. Because it's opening up doors to major, major corruption of people from local level, municipality to departments, to use a Zulu phrase, Mazama Luzong Susan Nesgisla, Beba be deal, Abanoma in to be able to arrive at a technological capability. CETA, we will be quiet on this thing. CETA is going to collapse this country. It just does not make sense how we speak 4IR on one hand and the State Information Technology Agency is at 1IR. There's no coherence in its operation. I'm just raising it as this digitization project shouldn't really, if we were, you know, your 500,000 and the 3 million, it should be a basic theater function. It's so elementary. I'm just flagging it together, Uchi. In all these challenges that are there, you want to manage hospitals better in terms of technology, you've got this kind of theater. The list is endless of where we can list the deficiencies of theater. And it goes to also case management with this disciplinary process. Some of it hinges on the fact that there's no capability in terms of technology. Yeah, anyway, Minister, the response to those two things, monthly reports, first one due end of March, and then we will meet you in the second quarter, probably in June sometime. No, we'll comply. Of course, we still have. Yeah, you heard, Minister. Vetting comes up. Right, colleague? All right. Once we've received our feedback from legal, we'll see the Minister again in his other capacity. I want to... Well, I don't know. I'm not privy to the reshuffle dynamics. Oh, I see. All right. Colleague, tomorrow is budget day, and so we will not meet because everybody seems preoccupied. But there is the closed session budget briefing for members who will be interested, and we will communicate details for the closed session for members who may want to be part and parcel of that. The draft report on India will reach you by the end of the week. It's done for your input, and then we will do that. Minister, I want to thank you and the DDG, Jeffrey Absentia, and Team Advocate in TV, and your team as always. But we should be able to talk about Minister. I mean it in the context of a cooperative working relationship. A life in this table, like Kaya, we know AG and SIU. All right, colleagues, the house is sitting at 2 today. There's a sitting. And Sistombe, I'm going to Mark Building Lungi. Right, lunch is downstairs, colleagues, in the normal. You are invited. You are invited in the Mark Building restaurant at the ground floor. Colleagues, happy Tuesday, and the meeting stands adjourned.